very much, George. I think Bill is a first-time attending, or have you been here? He didn't get your blue dot. Anyway, blue dot for the man here in the corner. Yeah, Bill Walker is with the imaging is an imaging field services officer in the Dallas Public Library System, the Amigos Library System, and has been doing and thinking about the teaching of ideas and techniques relating to digitization of audio and video, and is going to share some of these this work that he's done in training about digitization, which I think I certainly still need, and I'm happy to have you here. Welcome to ARSC.
Good afternoon. Let me see if we got the do the control F8 ad nauseum. Okay. Uh-oh. Okay. I wasn't sure how much, how many people would be at this thing, A, because it was at the end of the day, and B, I just didn't know the size of ARSC. I have about 25 copies of the handouts, so if you want some, and if you didn't get one and you want one, you can ask me afterwards and give me an email message, and I'll send it to you. So somebody would like to hand these out. Just a little history of what Amigos Library Services is. We are a library services network. We started out as an OCLC cataloging network, but then preservation began to be on people's mind, traditional preservation of paper objects mostly. And so we got a hold of a preservation field services officer. And what happened was is that the preservation field services officer got a lot of questions about digital imaging, and what we're talking about here is scanning of text and photos mostly. So Amigos put together a task force, and they established an Amigos imaging field, an imaging services department. It was a separate department at first, funded by an NEH grant. I have the distinction of being the only NEH grant-funded digitization trainer in the United States, so hey. In 1999, the Amigos Imaging Service and the Amigos Preservation Service got together, and then in 2000, I took over. Uh-oh, are we still not, okay. So basically what my life as a trainer consists of is I basically learn the digitization technologies that my members need to know. My members, by the way, scan a geographic area that includes Arkansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and most recently California. So I learn these technologies on the fly. So I guess the first thing I need to say is I'm not an expert. Many of you in this room and just hearing this last conversation make me realize that a lot of you have a lot more experience than I do. So I'm a jack of many trades. I'm a master of none, really. I mean, the most experience I have in anything is music cataloging. So I learned how to do digital imaging on the fly with intensive training and research and reading, and so I learned how to do digital audio in 2002. And just to let you know that a rolling stone gathers no moss, I'm moving on to XML TEI. So, you know, digital audio's passe, adios, what can I say? Just kidding. My background, I do have a music background, so I consider myself to have an ear for this stuff. To a certain extent, I have a bachelor's in classical guitar, a master's of music and music theory from the University of North Texas, and I've had some experience transferring LPs to cassette tape. In fact, I used to do it the old-fashioned way. When I was in the eighth grade, I had a little realistic tape deck, and I had this speaker that I would and I would take the microphone and I would put it up close to a recording, and of course it was distorted as hell, you know, and you'd try and work with that, but it was Jimi Hendrix, so it's okay. So I have a little bit of recording experience, either in front of the microphone and doing stuff. But again, I had to learn a lot of this stuff on the fly. I also have a library science degree from the University of North Texas. I was a music cataloger at SMU for 8 years, and I was an Amigos cataloging trainer for 4 years before I took the imaging field services officer job. During these two positions, I was introduced to computers and what they could do by a guy named Bob Skinner. Bob Skinner and I both have in common that we were both students of Morris Martin in library school, in his music library class. So the more I worked as a librarian, the more I became involved with computers. My audience are staff from libraries, archives, museums, historical societies, and most of these institutions that I service are small to medium-sized institutions. Some of these have like one or two people with an archive with no volunteers. It's just a one-person operation. Amigos has nearly 850 institutional members, and most of these participants are new to digital audio. So who is digitizing audio besides all you guys? Of course, music and other libraries have used this as a means to improve service and to make these things available to students, especially during times before examinations where people are trying to learn enough about Beethoven's Third Symphony, so when the professor plays what used to be called drop the needle, I guess that's called drop the laser now, I don't know. Archives use it, and museums, educational institutions, they use it for oral histories, they use it to improve access to collections, and they use it to reformat deteriorating audio. And as we learned, if you attend that workshop, that great workshop yesterday, it looks like digital is going to be the way to go because analog is pretty quickly disappearing. What are they digitizing? Music reserve listening materials, folk and ethnic music collections, field recordings, music department recital and concert recordings, oral histories, language education materials, and probably some applications that I haven't found out yet about. So who accesses these objects? Students do. Reserve listening assignments, recital recordings, researchers, and so on. I'm having to go fast here because we're running short on time. But so how did I prepare for to develop this workshop? Well, the first thing I did is I took a workshop myself. The Colorado Digitization Project is a statewide digitization initiative, and they have been doing some work in digitizing oral history recordings. They started out doing digital scanning of text and photographs. I did a lot of reading, and I basically practiced digitizing audio. I listened, tried to be able to discern hiss and rumble and stuff like that. Most of my experience is using cassette tapes because that's most of what the libraries that I deal with use. And basically what I do is if somebody has 78s or wax cylinders, I say, go see a vendor. Go talk to George Blood or somebody else like that. Now, I have to take this workshop on the road. And that means that I have to put this stuff on airplanes. And so you're talking about taking sensitive electronic equipment, such as this computer. And so I had to compromise between what is good digital audio practice in terms of equipment acquisition and portability. So recommended, you'd probably want a desktop computer. you would also want an external sound card. Well, for the desktop computer, I have old Betsy here, my laptop. For an external sound card, I have a PCM CIA card, which isn't really external, but it's external enough. And you'll notice that when you make stuff like this, this is what you get for a board to plug things into. You've got some XLR inputs and outputs, some a mini plug for your headphones, and some what look to be SPDIF inputs and outputs. Basically, I use the XLR outputs. I did get a professional quality tape deck, but it's a portable one. Marantz PMD 430, and instead of monitor speakers, which are really heavy, I use computer speakers, but I got a really good high quality set of computer speakers that does a pretty good job on the road, and I basically tell my students get good monitor speakers and learn how to hear what's coming out of them. I got shielded cables. And so basically, that's basically what I use. And I carry it all in this. Learning objectives. One of the things you need to learn when you're doing any kind of digitization project is you need to come up with a criterion for evaluating a collection's suitability for audio digitization. What kind of condition are the materials in? What would be most appreciated and used by your constituency and so forth? You need to understand some of the major concepts related to copyright and performance rights for music and privacy in regard to oral history recordings. Outline the process by which sound waves are transformed into analog sound recordings. Understand the process of digital sampling, including the Nyquist theorem as it relates to standards for capturing digital audio. Describe the relationship between sampling rate, bit depth, and file space, which can, as we all know, sound files take up a lot of file space. Know what kinds of equipment are required to digitize common analog audio formats common in the last 50 years. Be able to capture a short audio segment, exercising rudimentary judgment and applying normalization and noise reduction. Know which file formats are best for archival storage, dissemination, and streaming audio. Know what standards exist for providing discovery, preservation, and rights metadata. One of the things that these people do who work for institutions is answer these questions. Who is your audience? Why are you digitizing this stuff in the first place? Will digitizing this stuff increase use? Is there already a demand for it? How are you going to use this? Is this going to be in-house use, either through distributing CDs or web distribution? And what is to be the disposition of the originals? Oral histories. Will users listen to tapes, read the transcripts, or both? If they're content with the transcripts, there's really no need to digitize the tapes. Are the analog sound sources organized? One of the things we discussed in that workshop yesterday was having some kind of organization. If you don't know what you have, if you have no inventory or anything like that, then there's really no way to come up with a digitization project. And of course, the all-important question, who owns the recordings? Can we transfer the sound to another medium? How fragile is the original? What are you going to have to do in order to basically make the original playable? What's the sound quality of the original? Even with all the technological magic, there probably still are some sound recordings out there that just won't respond to a recording in the first place. How loud is the original? Is there a lot of noise obscuring the recorded sound? What kind of condition do you have? Scratches, dust, sticky sheds, sticky tape? You have the oxide coming off the tape, things like that. Can the original be restored or repaired? We talked a lot about cleaning yesterday, using various techniques for cleaning 78s and stuff, restoring, tape baking, things like that, to make it so that you can actually transfer the sound off the original. So what I emphasize in this is you need to thoroughly examine your collection. What does it have? What condition is it in? Is it organized? And know the users of your collection, what they use and how they use it. And is there a potential for stuff that's not readily available to your public? Will they be able to, will digitizing that stuff make it more usable? One of the things I try to point out to the students is that copyright and licensing are much more complex than with print or photo digitization. There's often multiple layers of ownership. We talked about this yesterday. Sound recording for the copyright of the sound the record label has on it, the licensing, BMI, ASCAP, things like that, various other things. And I don't, because this is a one-day workshop, I can't go into a lot of detail about this. So basically what I'm trying to do here is make them aware of the issues so that they can go explore this stuff further. One of the things is that unless you get permission and pay somebody money, copyright and licensing restricts distribution. And of course, this is one part of the workshop that generates many questions. And of course, I have to give the usual disclaimer. Now, with oral histories, privacy is a big issue. When can we release these? Can we ever release these in a widely distributed way? The subject of privacy generates more questions oftentimes than copyright does. And again, I have to do my usual disclaimer. One of the things that people who aren't used to digitizing audio come from, one of the perspectives that they come from, is that when you take paper, if the paper is chemically stable, paper can last for centuries if you give it a good environment. If you make the temperature and humidity, that stuff will last. Magnetic tape, which is what we're mostly talking about with the people that I work with, has a much shorter lifespan. I've heard various quotes, but the quote that I hear is that in an optimum condition, and there may be disagreements about this, but tape will last about 30 years, good quality reel-to-reel tape. Of course, we're dealing with the obsolescence of the carrier. We talked about that the last manufacturer of reel-to-reel tape is going out of business. It's getting more and more difficult to find reel-to-reel tape players. And of course, one of the loaded questions I ask my students is, how long has it been since you've rewound your tapes? You're supposed to do that once a year. And of course, I get all these sheepish grins that, well, we haven't rewound them in 20 years or whatever. So, what I try to do is because of the issues involved, it's really difficult to say, well, you absolutely need to do this or absolutely need to do that, even though we are being pushed towards the digital realm. So I try to give them some advantages and disadvantages. For reformatting to another analog thing, i.e. reel-to-reel tape, the advantages is it's a mature technology. We've been working with this stuff for years. There are established standards out there. We know analog sound on tape. We know how long it'll last, the sound quality. And so we really have a long history with analog tape. The disadvantages is that every time you re-record from one analog tape to another, you have a generational loss of sound quality. Again, the players and recorders are hard to find. The world is going to digital sound. Just to give you an idea, when I bought that PMD 430 recorder, I went into a guitar center. And it's a big place. They have rock and roll guitars and drums and basses, and then they have a recording section. Well, when I was in there, I was perusing the area. There wasn't a reel-to-reel tape deck to be found within 3 miles of that place. There were a few cassette places, but everything else was digital. So we all know that the recording industry is going digital. The other thing is that when you really get deep into this, it often requires the skills of an audio engineer to really do a good job of dealing with this stuff. Digital reformatting, the advantages is that there's no generational loss when reformatting. It's easier to do than analog reformatting. There's more choices available for equipment. It's easily distributed, reproduced online or offline. That's really the unique thing about digital, is that it is so easy to distribute. The problem is it's a new technology. To quote George Blood, it's the devil we don't know. There are digital preservation issues. We know less about what will happen to digital media than we know what will happen to analog media. There are tests and stuff like that, but we really don't know how long CD-ROMs are going to last. And even if they last 100 years, will there be players available for them? And so what this requires is that people are going to have to be dealing with constant maintenance. From a legal standpoint, digital files also have authenticity issues. Digital things are much more easily changed than analog things, whether you're talking about sound recordings, video, photographs, you name it. And again, you have huge files, and in order to be able to send these over the web, you really need to compress them. So basically what I do is I basically start from ground zero and talk about what sound is, talk about how sound is converted into analog audio, at least in today's technology. Sound is converted to electronic voltage, and that's stored as magnetic flux or characteristics in a disc groove. And then the process is reversed during playback. Okay, will the previous speaker not hit me? I know that's an oversimplification, but we're dealing with beginners here. Okay. So, analog to digital process, we have this little wave right here. We have a process called sampling, and it gets converted into ones and zeros. And so I basically have my little analog playback device, my analog to digital converter, and then the signal goes into a computer where it's edited. Actually, according to Nitin Sampat, who teaches at the Rochester Institute of Technology, he said, digital imaging is very simple. The sound goes in, the numbers come out. And he said that digital imaging is very simple, but the same thing applies. You have something, an analog wave coming in and numbers coming out. One of the things I talk a lot about is sampling. I help people understand that sampling does not capture the entire analog wave, and that the higher the sampling rate you have, the more accurate the digital capture. But the flip side of that is that higher sampling equals larger files. And so one of the things I talk about is how we came up with the CD standard of 44.1 kilohertz, 16 bits, and I talk about the Nyquist theorem. There are other standards out there. Some institutions have recorded oral histories at as low as 11 kilohertz at 16 bits. And of course, the music industry is moving to 96 kilohertz, 24 bits as a minimum. There's even talk of 192 kilohertz. So I talk about the Nyquist theorem, which basically says that sound must be sampled at least twice its highest analog frequency in order to extract all the information from the bandwidth and accurately represent the original acoustic energy. Sampling it slightly more than twice the frequency will make up for imprecisions in filters and other components used for the conversion. So then I relate that to the average hearing range for human beings, and then we talk about how that happens, point out that that's for each channel, so if you're using stereo, you have to double that, and that basically gives you the standard for audio CDs. This is a little formula that I got off of a thing called howitworks.com, and basically this talks about how much converting bit depth and resolution, or bits and hertz, kilohertz, to file space. And just to kind of give them an idea, I show them this slide here, then talk about if you want to record it at CD thing, for 1 minute of recorded stereo, 44,000 hertz at 16 bits is 10 megabytes, all the way up to 96,000 hertz, 24 bits, that's 33 megabytes per minute of recorded sound. And so I basically tell these people that when they write their grants, be sure to include lots of file server space. And then I basically take them through an exercise where we have a bunch of 150 oral histories, and we basically calculate the file space for that. One of the things I talk about is equipment. I show basic and optimal configurations. One of the things that you need to understand when you're dealing with states, especially in this day and age, they're basically saying, okay, I know that up here is where I really should be, but I can only afford to do it down here. So what can I get by with? And so a lot of what I talk about is what you can get by with. I also need to help them deal with archival permanent digitization and also temporary quality sound digitization. In other words, are the archival files that you want to try and keep forever and the distribution files. And so basically I take them through this slide and talk about what kinds of things they need to do for certain types of discs. Basically, if they're dealing with anything before LPs, I strongly recommend that they go to a professional vendor who knows how to play that. And I clearly point out to them that if you play this stuff once in an incorrect way, you can ruin it forever. Here's more stuff here. One of the things I do emphasize is I say if you can afford anything, get an external sound card, because the internal sound card is just, it takes up too much computer noise because it's directly attached to the main system bus. And I basically draw these little things here. This is kind of the economy configuration. Here, the computer has an internal sound card. Here, we add the external sound card. And then if they're doing digitization from multiple sources, I say that it's nice to add an audio mixer so that you don't have to plug in and unplug things. Next, I talk about, we go through some demonstrations and we talk about recording levels. We talk about analog recording, that it's okay to peak in the red zone, that a little bit of distortion is okay. But in digital recording, at least the sources that I'm familiar with tell me that you need to stay well away from the red zone because digital distortion isn't as warm and fuzzy as analog distortion. And then you can use a process called normalization after that to boost the volume if you need to. And so we talk about normalization and help them to understand the differences between certain digital audio applications. I have a copy of SoundForge and a copy of Goldwave, and I used to have, before my hard drive crashed, a copy of CoolEdit Pro, which I haven't gotten around to reinstalling. And basically what I do with these is I basically show them what normalization looks like in each one of those. I talk about noise reduction. And one of the things I do is I try to err on the conservative side here because unless you're really professional, you can do a lot of damage to the original sound. I talk about how if you're recording a human speaker and there's a lot of hiss in the cassette, that if you cut out too much of that hiss, then the S's and some of the other consonants that the speaker make have this effect, what I call warbling, which sounds like you're actually speaking underwater through a scuba apparatus or something. And so you really have to be careful with that. And I basically say that if you're not sure, just basically eliminate noise reduction, or if it really bothers you, you really need to send these to a vendor. I talk about file types, and one of the things that I emphasize is that when I do regular digital imaging, just regular scanning of photographs, I mean, to you guys, audio is regular, but to everybody else, scanning text and photos is regular. So when I talk about scanning text and photographs, I try to tell people to use open file formats, such as TIFF and JPEG and stuff like that. The problem with audio recording is that all the file formats, with the exception of one that I can find, Vorbis AUG, are all proprietary. So basically, you're stuck using proprietary file formats. WAVE is owned by Microsoft. AIFF is owned by Mac. I thought MP3 was a open file format. It turns out it's owned by a German company called Fraunhofer. Open formats are preferable, but may not be possible with audio. Another thing that we need to deal with is metadata. And one of the things we talk about, most librarians and archivists say, okay, yeah, we need to have some way for people to find stuff. But with digitization, there's more metadata. One of the things you really need is something called preservation metadata, something that documents how the file was captured and how the file was preserved and what has happened to it since the file was created. Another thing you need for sound recordings, and this is becoming a big hot topic in the recording industry, is rights metadata. This can be something as simple as just putting a form of citation for anybody who wants to use this, but it can be something as complicated as digital behaviors that say, okay, you pay so much money with your MasterCard, and then you get to use this file three times, and then after that, your use is finished. Talk about discovery metadata, either MARC or AACR2 or something called Dublin Core. Dublin Core was meant to be a much simpler standard. It basically uses 15 elements, all of which are optional or repeatable. It's really easy to use, but the problem is that it doesn't have as much richness and depth as MARC does. The problem with MARC is that MARC is really only used in libraries. A lot of archives don't use MARC, museums don't use MARC, and so you kind of have to really figure out what community you're in and what metadata you're going to be using. One of the things that preservation metadata does is that it will help you aid in digital archaeology. If you have an encrypted, compressed file of audio, and this is 50 years, and all the people who invented that file format have died or retired, and you can't get a hold of them, how are you going to be able to recover that file and make it readable again? Talked about rights metadata. Now, the last part of this talk, I'll talk about the evaluation process. Amigos basically passes out evaluations, and my line is that in the perverse economics of Amigos training, I don't grade you, you grade me. So I hand out an evaluation in each training packet. And so far, the data have shown overall satisfaction with the workshop content, the instructor, the presentation, and the handouts. So far, I've taught 39 students in 5 sessions. This is a breakdown of the different types of people who've shown up. Amigos is trying to break into the archival community, into the records management community and stuff like that to be able to offer training for them, because there's a lot of things that we feel like we can offer, but still most of our clientele are librarians. One of the questions we ask is, what was your knowledge level before and after the session? Most people were in the beginner and average. Some were very knowledgeable. After that, the people basically stated that they felt like most of them felt like they were average to very knowledgeable. Some few people had no answer. Time allotted for the session. The interesting thing I thought here is that the time allotted was too much, and I felt like I was rushing to get through the material, but they felt like it was too much. Okay, make it a half-day workshop. evaluation of workshop content, four questions, session mentor expectations. The blue is strongly agree, the purple is agree, and so people were for the most part happy with that. Handouts were useful. I really like PowerPoint. A lot of people talk about the overuse of PowerPoint, but I will overuse this product until it goes away because it is the best way for me to come up with a flow for my workshop. It's the best way for people to have handouts so that they aren't frantically scribbling notes. And I get a lot of compliments about my handout stuff. And of course, I get to do fun stuff like the squirrely little sound wave there, which I worked hard at to get that effect. And then here's an evaluation of the instructor, and what can I say? They like me. That was wonderful. Selected comments. One person said the intro to the subjects, thought-provoking. Somebody else said it established basics, gave a greater understanding of the whole process. Some said it was a good overview of practical concerns for digitizing audio. And some people said they enjoyed the hands-on practice with audio software. Another student said that we could never do more hands-on. And another student said ideally there would be several workstations that people could use for hands-on work and a full digital audio digitization setup that folks could examine. Well, we use institutional labs, and they basically offer these things to us for free, so it's very difficult to come up with these kind of setups. Overall, there's satisfaction with it, but one of the challenges is trying to incorporate a meaningful hands-on process, because what happens is that they basically use my equipment, and so I divide them up into groups, and they come up, and they do a little bit of hands-on and stuff like that, and some have actually opted out of that because they didn't think it would be meaningful enough. One of the challenges that we're coming up with is that as people are finding it harder and harder to travel to places, Amigos is trying to move to a distance education venue. The problem with this workshop and distance education is the transport of large audio files over the internet, and even small audio files. If your user doesn't have a good connection, a large bandwidth connection, then sound just really sounds horrible on the internet. We use a thing called Centra eMeeting, and the actual work is hosted by Centra. You upload your presentation and other things onto the Centra server. It uses voice over IP. Centra basically takes your PowerPoint conversion and converts it into JPEG or GIF files. And then it also allows for application sharing. One of the things that it doesn't do well is quizzing. The program that Centra puts out, which is Centra Symposium, costs a lot more than e-meeting, and so we're basically living with that problem. So as I said before, the large size of audio files makes online demonstrations difficult or impossible. Another problem is that the varying bandwidths of students for anywhere from 28.8 all the way up to T1 makes it really difficult for everybody to get the same sound experience, which is really important in this, because if somebody's getting this crackly piece of junk coming through and somebody's hearing it loud and clear, it really doesn't allow for people to equally evaluate a given sound clip. So, my conclusions, there's been overall satisfaction with the workshop. I've had to make compromises in equipment and in workshop venues make listening difficult. Like I said, it would be nice to have a good quality pair of audio speakers, but I just don't trust the luggage people with that, and so I basically had to create a workshop package that I could carry on the plane with me. Again, good hands-on experience make it difficult for traveling, for a traveling workshop. And probably this workshop will remain a face-to-face workshop for the foreseeable future. Thank you all for listening, and thank you all for your having me at this ARFSC meeting. Are there any questions?
Who's that?
That's my cat. That's Momoko-chan. Yes. Yeah, I'm being pessimistic on purpose because the thing that I don't want them to do is to be lulled into complacency. Your optimal thing is assuming that people take care of the tape, and a lot of the people in the institutions that I work with don't know to take care of the tape until I tell them to, that you have to rewind it once a year, and okay, well.
I don't want to take a lot of the little time here because it's another important issue that the fight has, but you don't have to rewind the tape. The other issue is on the cassette, the issue of this is to check to see if it's got Dolby or not.
Right, yeah, that's true. Anybody else? Well, that is what I call the big enchilada question, is how are we going to keep this stuff going in perpetuity? Because eventually, even given Stephen's statement about tapes, 50 years is not 500 years for paper or microfilm, which is supposed to last that long. And so you're still dealing with a relatively short-term lifespan of something, and for digital, we just don't know. There's been a lot of artificial aging studies of CDs, but that's artificial aging. That's not the same as the thing lasting 100 years. And even if it does last 100 years, you have the other issue that you need to deal with, and that's obsolescence of the equipment. Just to give you an idea of how things are changing, right now CDRs are pretty common. Everybody's putting stuff on Mitsui Gold CDRs, but everybody's kind of, looking at DVD. Well, I've got news for you. DVD, the end of DVD may be near because there's a consortium of companies in Japan, companies in academic institutions in Japan, that are working on 1 terabyte DVD discs. And so we may need a whole new set of players for that kind of stuff. So it just goes on and on and on. And the thing that in the golden age of analog audio stuff, I mean, reel-to-reel tape decks lasted for 40 years. We don't know. Most technology forecasters that I've read and talked with, the average lifespan, either because it falls apart or because it becomes obsolete of a digital format is 5 years. And so we really have some very challenging issues to look at as we move to digital audio.
Give me a headache.
Just don't shoot the messenger, okay? What can yeah.
I can speak my own voice. I was thinking that some people are promoting the use of what they call mass storage systems. That is, to get your digital data into an organization that takes responsibility for digital data. Banks have done it for years. I mean, they have staff going and backing up all the time. And you would need the same thing here, because the only thing you can be certain of is that if you have it in some digital form and you continuously water the system and have somebody else take responsibility to move it, for moving it to new servers all the time, then that's something that you will have to pay for, but at least the digital data will be preserved, as you said, completely unchanged.
Well, there's several issues here, but I can give you some examples. How many of you are familiar with OCLC? I don't know how many of you are librarian. Most of you, I guess, half of you. OCLC is getting into they've come up with a new unit. It's called the Digital and Preservation Resources. Part of that is their digital archive. The problem with OCLC's digital archive for the small and medium-sized institutions that I deal with is that it's prohibitively expensive. It's about $16,000 a year plus $5 a gigabyte per month of storage. Okay, how many of you can afford that? If all your audio files were digitized, could you all afford that? Okay, neither can my institution. So you're talking about incredible cost. Another thing is a thing called DSpace, which is put out by MIT and I believe Hewlett-Packard. It's basically a set of freeware, but your expense there is going to be hiring skilled professional IT people who can basically keep that going. And the interesting thing about OCLC's thing is they'll only deal with images. They won't touch audio yet. They will not touch MP3. They will not touch WAV. It's just too complicated for them. And so we're really in the very new aspects of this. This, by the way, is the title of another workshop that I teach called Digital Preservation in an Uncertain Future. Mm-hmm. Yes? I basically recommend that people use CDRs, but I recommend that they look at it as mid-term storage, not long-term storage, that they really need to be constantly looking at these things, making sure that they still work, doing fixity checks on the data, and also kind of be doing technology forecasting to see what comes next, because basically digital... Maintaining digital files is like being on a rolling log. In real life, the log rollers in the Northwest can basically roll on their logs and then they can hop onto shore. With digital stuff, there's no shore, so you're constantly rolling. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. 9 o'clock tomorrow is 8:30. I forget. Who has a program?